Like me for another week. This is somewhere in the mid-50s. I can't remember which Don is responsible for that, so we'll let him do it. Our guest is Barbara Mattson this morning. How are you?
Fine.
That's the first thing I want to know. And you are, what city are you in?
I'm in Spartanburg. That's Spartanburg, not Spartansburg. It don't got an S.
Love it. It don't got an S in the middle of it. Not no. Spartansburg, but Spartanburg.
Burg, South Carolina. South. I think there is a Spartanburg, Pennsylvania, or something like that, but I'm just playing just one Spartanburg.
Just one Spartan.
Right. All right. Well, one Spartan,
that's
yeah.
Good to know. And what brought you to that city? Were you born and raised there, or what?
Well, that's an interesting story in itself. I was born in Dunkirk, New York. And that's not too terribly far from the snow capital of the world in Buffalo. And my parents decided, actually my father's father decided he wanted to farm down here in a little old place called Ennery, South Carolina. So we moved down in about, I'm just going to say in 49, which was when I was about 2 years old. I just told my age. And
I actually think you did, didn't you? You just gave away the big secret.
Yeah, that secret's now out of the bag.
Oh, well.
So my parents farmed there in Ennery, South Carolina. And not far away was the school for the blind, the state school for the blind, which is in Spartanburg. And, of course, I started there when I was around six. That was before the state law enacted that there was a kindergarten. So mm-hmm. I started kindergarten at six instead of five when most kids start kindergarten now. Now I understand the school takes kids as early as two and three. Can you imagine? So
The blind school does?
Uh-huh. And I presume that's what they call an early development program. And I just really don't know too much about that, but golly gee, I'm almost glad that I didn't start that early.
And they house three-year-olds in a dormitory situation. That's cruel and unusual punishment, folks.
Well, I would think so, because I kind of appreciate the bonding that I had in those early years. You know, I think they say if you have a child by the time, you know, before and by the time they're six, you've got them. And I just do wonder about some of the effects of having kids that far away that early.
From their parents and their home environment. 'Cause I remember being little. I didn't know it was really that much different than other kids until I went off to school with all those other blind people. You know,
right.
How that goes. So you, your parents moved to the city where the blind school was?
Well, we were near it. I say near it in terms now. It's only about 30 minutes away from Ennery, South Carolina. But mm-hmm. Back then, it took about an hour or so to get to the from Ennery to Spartanburg because there were no interstates.
Well, yeah, and you were driving on two-lane highways, and cars didn't go
exactly
nearly as fast then as we do now. So they. What about other sisters, brothers, siblings? What do you have any?
Oh golly, yeah, I'm the oldest of five.
Really?
Yeah.
Any other eye problems?
No. And this was the interesting part about it. They did not know when I was born. One of my aunts noticed that my eyes were just kind of not really making contact and this sort of thing. And so she suggested that my parents take me to be tested. And it was at that time they discovered that I had optic nerve atrophy, and they did not know what the cause was. And I don't know whether any doctor who's looked at me since hasn't been able to determine with any better clarity what the origin was. And of course back then they didn't, and I think they did all kind of tests to find out, and they just didn't know. And
still don't know.
Still don't know, and my I do have some vision. I have had in the past as good as about 2400 in my left eye with maybe light perception in the right. Mm. Now I don't have anything in the right. They tell me, I don't know, maybe I've got phantom vision there because I still think that I can cover my left eye and think that I still see something out of the right, but apparently I don't. And I probably have something like 2800 in the left eye. Now I count fingers at about a foot.
And can you see well enough to read the computer screen, or do you have to use JAWS or window eyes?
I use JAWS. I could probably see well enough, and I do. I can see if the letters are big enough. I can see to read it, but reading in that matter is very slow. I did use large print at first, but the school was very nice to me and taught me Braille very early as well. So when I finally transferred completely over to Braille in the first time when I went through the third grade, they decided to keep me back a year to get my Braille skills up. So that put me basically 2 years behind, which made it kind of nice because my oldest sister and I graduated on the same year, so we kind of had that to share together.
Now, you alluded to your second year in the third grade. Did you not do well in the third grade?
They kept me back to get my Braille skills up so that I could read better, and I appreciate that because what happened was eventually I passed the fifth grade on trial, and so I was I might have ended up at some point actually failing anyway, but I was very, very intent on getting through the the sixth grade because in the sixth grade I got to start to learn to type and take home economics. And I did not want to go back to fifth grade and lose those wonderful courses. So I really, really, really tried hard the first 6 weeks in the sixth grade. Anyway, what happened after that, I don't know. But I was bound and determined that I was going to continue. And I failed typing the first 6 weeks or nearly it. But I think the teacher was grading at that point on what I would say a wrong scale for beginner typers versus, typers mm-hmm. who are more experienced.
Yeah.
But that didn't discourage me because I really enjoyed learning to type. Apparently there was some writer that was coming out in me then, and I wanted to learn to type so I could start writing letters and writing all kinds of other things. And so that other people besides me and my teachers for the blind could read it.
And, of course, at that time you were typing and you had no idea if you if the ribbon was actually working or and if you made a mistake, you had no way of going back and correcting it.
Well, right. Not like in the sense of computer terms. You'd backspace and go yeah. XXX over yes. whatever you had typed and you would go on. But you're right. You didn't have any idea of whether it was writing, and actually, these days you don't know whether your printer is printing or not. To say you've got that kind of same challenge again, unless you've got something, some assistive device, which I think some people have used these light detectors or something in order to at least detect whether there's ink or print on the page. I don't know exactly how that works, but I believe that's what some people have used.
But you at least know that you type, you know, the words that are in the computer somewhere, and you can print
right.
them, whereas before. And so your Braille skills, how did that take? Are you a Braille person? Are you?
Oh, definitely. All the way. My Braille word processor I use has a Braille display, and I wouldn't have it any other way. The Braille displays are much more, make a device like that much more expensive, but I've got to see it to believe it, more or less, and I had a real difficult time when I went to college learning to listen to tapes and comprehend what I'm reading by tape versus having it all in Braille, because all my books in my high school and
yeah.
what have you were all Braille.
You're used to that sensory information coming to you through your hands.
Exactly. And so when I started college, it was a real, real challenge to start training my ears to comprehend the same type of information that my fingers, I almost said my eyes, that's how connected my
yeah.
fingers are to my eyes.
I understand. I understand. Now, yeah. but let's don't get you quite out of into high school, into college yet. Let's talk about some of your school. Did you live at the school for the blind in a dorm situation, or go home
yeah,
there?
Yeah. When I up until I was about in the seventh grade, and that was when my parents moved up here to Spartanburg, because by then my dad was in construction here,
mm-hmm.
and so then for a few years, I commuted, and my parents happened to live just a couple miles away. I think one reason they decided to live where they lived was because they knew it wasn't far from the school. They knew that my sisters and brothers then could get a school bus to school, but back then, there were no buses that commuted day students. And so my parents had to take me. Now they've got several buses that commute kids to surrounding cities about, I'd say, 30, 45 minutes away.
That take them to the blind school every day.
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems to be a kind of a new thing. Of course, like we talked a while ago, we've got faster cars and bigger buses now, so we can, those kinds of things can be done. How did you, I guess you've indicated that you like school pretty well, and you did fairly well in it, other than that little problem in the third grade.
Yeah, where I was more or less out of necessity having to change from Braille to, from
print to Braille, yeah.
print to Braille, because my eyes were getting rather fatigued with reading the large print anymore.
All right. Well, how did high school go? What did you participate in then? What sort of things did they have at this?
Well, I'd say about the fourth grade up, I was in what you call, I guess, maybe the more senior chorus. And I started taking piano lessons when I was in the second grade. And so I pursued that pretty much all through until the senior year. And I think I dropped piano for a little while, and I also took up clarinet for a while, but I didn't have enough hot air to continue with that.
I can't. That surprises me.
I know.
I would. I didn't think you were going to be a talker, and sure enough, you are. And I'm glad. That's what we need.
Yeah.
And so you took piano, and you participated in the high school band. They had a band, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, they had the high school band. And there was a lot of things that changed my senior year in high school because we integrated at that
okay.
point. And
this was 60 what? 60?
66, 67
67,
years.
Yeah.
And so in that year, there was, I did not take any music besides chorus because our periods were dropped from 9 periods a day to 6 periods a day. I think there was also some additional school requirements that you had to have at least apparently an hour for each, you know, subject
each,
that you were taking.
Yeah, and, but so they made the periods longer and less of them.
Right. So you had to limit the number of things that you took by then. And I can't recall whether I continued home economics, but I do know that I continued my typing because the only vocation that I saw open to me at that time was something in typing. Now, the boys had possibility of shop, massage, or piano tuning. But I think to a certain degree, the school felt that we girls were going to be homemakers. And if we weren't going to be homemakers, so that, like I say, the only other vocation that I was beginning to be trained in was typing. So I pursued my typing, took some sort of dictaphone-type course. I can't remember or don't know whether I did well in that or not, but apparently the Commission for the Blind must have thought I did well enough to let me continue. And I went over to this medical transcribing. We took medical transcribing, some of us, out of the Greenville, South Carolina General Hospital. And so I did that for about a year afterwards. But maybe I need to go back and talk a little bit more about my high school, because what we also did that year was there were two little clubs that were started. And I remember going to maybe something like a drama thing and a literary club where we read a book together. And so those were different. Those were something that had not ever been before in my high school years.
Now, this was for sighted kids also, or just for...
No, this was just all within the
school
for the
blind.
Just blind
kids. Okay. And it was a reading? It was a, what exactly was it?
I think what we did, I seem to remember there was a teacher who read different books to us in that club that may not have been accessible in Braille or any other means.
Okay.
And I just, truly, I can't remember exactly what we did in this drama club. I don't exactly remember actually getting up and doing any plays or anything, but that was a talent and an interest that I discovered later on in life.
That's what I was going to say. You kind of alluded to the fact that you're a writer of some sort. I tell you what, we're about 17 minutes. Let's take a little short break and come back and talk about finishing you up in high school and then get you into college and see what you did. Barbara Madsen is our guest. Be back in just a second with more of Blind Like Me.
We'll record our 100th Blind Handyman Show. And you're invited to the celebration. We'll begin Friday, November 5th at the Sheridan on JFK Boulevard. Saturday, we'll have special motivational speakers and panel discussions on blindness issues.
Then it's Saturday night and on to live music and karaoke.
Sunday morning, we'll record our 100th Blind Handyman Show.
And we've got something special planned for Sunday afternoon.
Then it's Sunday night and time for more live music and karaoke.
All in all, a great weekend to meet old friends and make new ones.
For more information, call 936-634-9500 or email philparr@txucom.net. Reservations and meeting room space are limited. It's first come, first serve.
Join us in Houston, Texas this November, and we'll guarantee you a weekend you'll not soon forget.
936-634-9500.
Talk to you.
back with Barbara Mattson from South Carolina, and we have her through. She's a good Braille reader, as most of everybody is but me. And we have her through a grade school, grammar school, high school, got her into high school, and you were so this whetted your appetite for literature and for writing, you think, this writing club you said you went to?
I don't really know. I really don't remember exactly. I'll tell you where it really started. It was in college.
Okay, that's where you fell in love with writing. We decided you wanted to be a...
Yeah, and I don't write much poetry, but that's where I started writing because I lost an uncle that was real dear to me. And somehow or another, the way that I expressed my grief or my loss at the time was in this poetry that started coming out. And I started writing more and more poetry, and I became a part of a literary group at that college at the time. And we would submit poems that we had written to the leader, and we would submit them anonymously. And then we would come together with all the, and the leader would distribute a poem, and everybody would read it, and then we would critique it, and nobody but the person who had written it would know. And it was really nice.
The only person that would know who had written it was the person
who had authored it. And so sometimes when we'd be sitting there critiquing a poem, I would watch to see who was the quietest, because usually the one who was the quietest was the one whose poem was being critiqued.
Well, unless the poem was given great accolades and really talked up as being one of the world's great pieces of poetry, then they would say,
I would not have a tendency to sit and comment and critique on my own work.
Well, no, you wouldn't, would you?
Right. And so, therefore, I would be very quiet if my poetry was being...
That's an interesting concept, an interesting way of I've never heard of that. That would be, I don't know whether it would be fun or not, depending on whether you'd written the poem.
Well, I didn't feel threatened by it. I welcomed the feedback because I liked the people who, and I respected their opinions, the people who were critiquing. And I think that's helped. That helps. Now, probably if I didn't like somebody, and I would just say, no.
Yeah, that's good.
I don't respect anything that you say and forget.
Yeah, that's true. So what did you major in college?
I eventually majored in psychology. My original intent was to major in some sort of special education or the handicapped, because there was a rehab teacher at the Commission for the Blind down in South Carolina who wanted me to help her. She wanted me to be her assistant. The Commission for the Blind at the time would not hire anybody unless they had a college education. And so that was, and this rehab teacher actually was part of my extra inspiration for even going to college, because I got to back up and tell you that in high school, one of the teachers said to us, in essence, you will never make it in college. And
Wait a minute. This teacher said you will talk to the whole class.
To all of the class, in talking to all of the class, said, you will never make it in college.
What a terrible...
You would not ever make it in high school. Now, this teacher herself was legally blind, which makes it really astounding to me.
That's a terrible thing to say, but especially coming from a blind person who obviously had done college.
Exactly.
And had a teaching certificate.
Right. But back then, I thought that all my teachers knew what they were talking about. It's kind of like when you're really a young child, you think your parents are right, even if they're wrong. And so this is exactly what happened. So a year through medical transcribing after school, and then I went down to the Columbia Rehab Center, and apparently at some point I had had an IQ test, and the Commission for the Blind saw my potential, and this rehab teacher saw my potential and said, you really ought to go to college. And I thought she was out of her tree. I've already had somebody tell me who I respected.
That you couldn't do college.
That I couldn't do college. And so, anyway, so even to get to college was a real milestone for me. I was trembling in my boots and shivering in my shoes and all of that. And I said, and my parents didn't say, no, don't go, but they didn't encourage me. And I just felt like I was in the world all alone, just wondering what was going to happen.
See, that's the purpose of this program, is to dissuade those sorts of fears.
Yeah.
If you hear blind people who have done this thing, you figure, well, maybe I can do it if they did. But you'd already had a year's training in medical transcription.
Right. And this, and after a few months at the rehab center, and I was sitting around, waiting for a transcription job, and it didn't come, and it didn't come, and I kept getting these vibes from this rehab teacher, go to college. I thought, why not?
Might as well.
Well, yeah, because nothing was coming to fruition. I was interested in being her assistant, and I thought, well, if the Commission for the Blind needs a degree in order for me to go back and do that, that's fine. I'll do it.
I better go get a degree then.
Yeah. And it was really, really strange that the set of circumstances that started developed while I was in college, because when you're in college, you start taking courses and developing other interests. And when I was in junior college, I went to the Spartanburg Methodist College. It was Spartanburg Junior College at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt comfortable there because my oldest sister had been there. And so I had already gotten acquainted with some of the people there and the campus and this sort of thing. So I felt at home there. But at any rate, I took a course in psychology. And I said, oh, yeah, I really like this. And so by the time I had decided to go to Columbia College down in Columbia, South Carolina, and continue my special education, I had decided to change my major.
And to become a psychologist.
Yeah, and to major in psychology. And I thought, well, I wasn't really sure how far psychology would take me, so I decided that in the meantime, my sister was deciding she wanted to be a teacher, and I said, that sounded good to me, that maybe I should at least try for my teaching certificate. And so I did.
But all thoughts of working for the commission, that was over. That you weren't going to do that.
Yeah, that was over for the time being. I decided I was going to be a teacher and major in psychology. And so I did. I went through practice teaching. And practice teaching teaches you a lot.
You were going to be a psych instructor?
Yeah. And so what my major was social studies, which included psychology, sociology, and history. Now, I did not care much about history. And so I felt really, really lucky that I was able to practice teach in the field that I majored in, which was psychology. And so I did.
And now practice teaching at a
public school.
That's what I was going to say. At a high school.
Or? At a public high school.
And you were still at that time. You had some sights.
Yeah, and I still have some sights.
Yeah, but you had more then than you do now.
Well, yeah, but not functionally that much more than I have now.
But you weren't facing 50 kids totally blind.
Right.
Which would be terrifying.
Well, I think that facing a bunch of kids as a sighted person can be terrifying, particularly in this day and age when discipline is probably more of a problem. So what I decided was that I would teach in a private school where the classes were smaller.
Okay.
Now, let me tell you, there may be people listening, well, how did you deal with things like testing and this sort of stuff? There were some bookwork things that I had a partner teaching, an assistant teaching with me in some classes. But there were some bookwork things that I believe was handled by either my partner or the teacher whose classes I was teaching, which would have been my supervising teacher. And I also did double tests. So I had tests that had multiple choices, but what I did was the students, all around any given student, was students that had different tests. So in other words, I put out one test to one student, and then the next test student behind them got a different test, et cetera, et cetera. And then on the next aisle, there was...
Okay, different...
You see,
so,
where
but
I'm
whose idea was that? Yours or the school's, or how did that...
No, I made up these tests.
Wow.
But I had to do two different tests so that the multiple choices were not going to be the same. So that's how I got around the possibility of cheating.
That would prevent it, practically, wouldn't it?
Yeah, because the student, any given student, was sitting around students that did not have the same test.
But this, I guess you did this a year, the student teaching for a year.
Yeah, well, it was for a semester.
And so that you decided then that, well, maybe public school would not be a good place, but it would be nice if you had a nice, neat little private school where all the kids were quiet, and that would be a little easier, a little better for a blind. And you're right, it would be.
But let me tell you what else I wanted to do.
All right.
I wanted to actually do counseling in the school.
Sure.
Was really where I wanted to go. And I said this to my vocational counselor, and he said, well, counselors are a dime a dozen. And I said, okay, I understand that, but I still want to do that. So he did not support me for wanting to go get my master's.
This was your person at the Commission for the Blind.
And that was another thing. So, if there's anything that I would say to people out there, if somebody discourages you, and you really still have in your deep in your soul that you really want to do this, don't let them stop you.
Don't let them deter you. There's
exactly. So I started the proceedings on my own because I had money. If the commission wasn't going to pay for it, I had money that my dad's father had willed to me, and I was going to go to school on my own
Let me guess. Once you decided to do that, the commission decided they'd help you. No?
No, because I didn't. Let me tell you what happened. I didn't get that far. I got started, and my counselor came and said to me, we have a job for you.
Okay.
Down in Charleston, teaching out of one of our satellite areas in home teaching. Well, you know, this was the original plan. I was going to be a rehab teacher, right?
Yeah, but that had long since been abandoned.
Right.
Yeah.
Supposedly. However, I mean, they say things come full circle. Well, this is, I guess, kind of the way it did, because I thought, okay, he's already told me counselors are a dime a dozen. I could go all the way through this master's degree in counseling and still not come out with a job, and it may be much harder for me to get a job. And I was ready to bite the bullet.
Because you had a B.A. at that time already.
I had a B.A.
In psych and history or whatever.
In psychology. And teaching certificate, which I kept up for several years. I had that thing renewed. You have to renew them about every 5 years. You have to take a couple courses, one in your field and one other elective.
Sure.
And I kept that until, I think the last time that I renewed it was 91, and I thought, well, if I haven't taught by now, I probably won't.
Probably not. You want to
So I let it lapse. But I kept it all those years, which I was thankful for because it got me back into school and into the college and taught me more and more and more. And I really, really enjoy learning. But back to the fact that here I had this job offer. I said, fine, that sounds good. So they sent me out to what was then Arkansas Enterprises for the Blind, which is now World Blind Lions Center, out in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it.
Yeah. And so I was, for the first 4 weeks, I think it was, or maybe only two, I just don't remember. You know how time destroy
the commission thought they always want to send you somewhere for some evaluation or training. I mean, that's what they do.
But this, I was, the way this center did things was they evaluated your original baseline skills to find out how good you were before they thought that you were going to teach them, which sounds reasonable. But this was the part that was kind of weird because I was put in with all the other trainees at the time. And naturally, in that process, I made friends and enjoyed the people and this sort of thing. And suddenly, when I became a professional, I ended up moving out of that center training, where the original trainees are, and put in a different housing situation, which was nice because I ended up with a room of my own, which was just a bath and a bedroom area. I still took my meals at the center there in the dining room. But one of the things that was expected of me at the time was to more or less break all relations with the trainees there, men and women. And that was difficult. And I got called on the carpet once, at least once, about that situation.
For fraternizing with the trainees?
Uh-huh.
That seems so ludicrous, doesn't it?
Well, and I don't know whether that's part of the center's policy. There are, I understand some reasonings behind it, but I would suggest that that if a person is eventually going to come in as a professional, that to separate them to begin with.
Well, that's what I was thinking, because a lot of these people who were training there had no college, no degree, were right out of high school, and here you were with a bachelor's of arts degree in psychology.
Well, and
so,
most of them were there for the actual rehab training itself. They were there as nearly blinded people or people losing their sight or whatever.
And you were there for evaluation, basically.
And I was there for evaluation and eventual training to learn to be a rehab teacher. And at that center, I actually did some teaching, teaching of Braille and various and sundry other things.
Sure.
One of the things, though, that I feel that the center should have made me do was to move out into an apartment, which I was given that option. I was given that option of moving out into an apartment so that I would have ended up having to commute. I would have ended up having to clean my own apartment, cook, do all this stuff that I was actually needing to teach my trainees to do.
And that you were actually going to have to do in the real world.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
And I would, and if there was another thing that I hope that the center is doing now, it's making the professional people come in and do what they're actually going to have to do in the real world. Because when I got down to Charleston, South Carolina, and did end up in the real world, It was a big, big adjustment.
Yeah, I can imagine. All right, let us take it. We're a little bit late. Let us take our little second break, and then we've got you through with college and actually maybe fixing to go to work. Barbara Mattson is our guest. Back in just a minute with more Blind Like Me. Hang on.
Hi, my name's Donna, and for the past 5 years, I've lived up here in the cold country, Rochester, Minnesota. I'd love to move
love
to a warmer
is
place,
blind.
But, you know,
the audio magazine
you know
for singles.
Anyway, I'm around 32 years old, give or take a couple of years, and never been married. Oh, come close once or twice, but things just didn't work out.
If you'd like more information about this exciting new magazine, phone toll-free 1-877-222-0679. That's 1-877-222-0679. Or you can receive the same information as an email. Our address is loveisblind, all one word, at blindlikeme.com. That's loveisblind at blindlikeme.com. Blind Sites. Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sites, here's Tim Cummings.
Are you interested in old wax recordings, the kind made by Thomas Edison at the turn of the century? Well, then you should check out www.tinfoil.com. That's right, T-I-N-F-O-I-L.com. They have quite a vast collection of old wax cylinders that have been transferred to the computer. They describe the whole process of how they transfer them, and it's quite interesting. You can hear old songs, pieces of old plays, poetry, things like that. And if you actually have old recordings yourself that you want restored, you can mail them. They'll tell you how to do it. You can mail them to the person who runs the website. He will transfer them to CD for you so you can have them to play in your own home. Again, that's www.tinfoil.com. I'll give it a screen reader accessibility rating of an 8. And for Blind Sights, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights.
We are back visiting with Barbara Mattson, and you've had quite an interesting life. You've made it interesting by different decisions that you've made, and so we have you at the center in Little Rock, Arkansas, to being evaluated. That was their main thrust there, right? They wanted to see what you could do.
Well, they evaluated me for a couple of, like I say, I can't remember how long I was in that dorm situation with all the other trainees and making friends and this sort of thing, and then when I became a professional and they started teaching me how to teach, I moved into a one bath bedroom little, shall I say, mini apartment, because it didn't have a kitchen at all, and just across the street from the actual center part. And so that's where I lived for the most of the time. Now, so then they taught me how to teach all these things, and they taught me, and somewhere along the way, I was actually learning some of these things myself, because they had their certain methods that they wanted, that they felt like teachers ought to be teaching, very organized ways of knowing that you've covered an area if you're mopping a floor or vacuuming a floor, and ways of just doing cooking things and this sort of thing. Well, I wasn't much into that, but I really enjoyed teaching the Braille and this sort of thing.
But they wanted you to eventually to go to newly blinded people's homes or older and teach them how to cook and mop and sweep and make beds.
So, also while I was there, though, I learned how to use an opticon, which was one of these things, little devices that vibrated
the
shape of a letter up into a little trough-like thing. And so I spent some extra time there learning that because they felt at that time, and this is another interesting thing, they did evaluate me for low vision devices, but nothing in the way of a CCTV, which were beginning to come out at the time. The CCTVs were beginning to come out. But they didn't apparently have one or something like that. So I think that was why they decided that I would use this opticon. Me being a Braille reader, I guess they also felt more that I was a touch person instead of a sight person. And so I learned to use it, and the commission bought me one for my independence for reading various and sundry things. Well, it was so slow for me. Now, some people could use these things and use them well.
I talked to a lady the other day that reads her, or read at one time, her computer screen with one.
Yes. I know a lady who has done that, too. Maybe the same one, I don't know. But at any rate...
Mary Emerson? Is that who you...
I know that name.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I spent a little extra time getting that training so that that gave me a little bit of independence. And what I liked about the opticon was because it was much more portable than some of these, at least the first CCTVs that came out. So if I got a package and I wanted to know who this package was from, I could read the label and find out. Well,
it's really funny that the opticon was kind of one of the big breakthroughs for blind people.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden one day I didn't know about them, but all of a sudden one day they didn't make them anymore.
Right.
I've never understood that.
Well, I think it was because the optical character recognizers and all this other stuff came in. The problem with this, with the optical character recognition stuff, was that it was not as portable. You couldn't stick a box. It would have been very difficult or much, much cumbersome to stick a box on the scanner and read it and this sort of thing. But it was where I feel like the technology kind of did us a disjustice in a way when the optical character recognition came along, and I think Telesensory thought...
Well, we got computers and things like that they decided they wouldn't need.
Yeah, Telesensory thought, well, nobody's going to need this anymore.
So we'll quit making it.
Yeah, and I think there was a big hoopla because of that, but apparently not strong enough that Telesensory thought...
Well, there are blind people who swear by them and wouldn't be without one that you see in magazines all the time, people repairing them and or somebody, you know, so there's a generation of blind people that I've never seen one.
Yeah.
So anyway, you learned to do the opticon, and you had to learn some home skills if you were going to be a home teacher. They had to.
Right.
I gather that you don't like cooking, and you're not much on the domestic things.
Yeah, I'm really not much on the domestic things. So I would say, looking back on my teaching and what have you, it was a bust for me. I really felt when I came in, there was a mobility teacher there at the time.
Yeah.
And she had been teaching all of these things, so I felt like, to a certain degree, I kind of followed her along with a lot of the domestics for a while, and she helped me with that. And my big thing was probably teaching the people the Braille.
All right, now we're getting a little short. Did you end up taking this commission job working for the commission?
I did.
For the blind?
And the other disadvantage of this home teaching job was that it seems like we spent much, much time on the road and little time teaching. Now I think they just really urge people to come into the center there in Columbia, and I think they do some satellite teaching and bring in a bunch of people into a particular place, maybe down in Charleston or maybe over in Greenville.
And try to do them in a all together.
And try to do it all in. But where I see that that is a problem is that it takes the people out of their home, and then when they have to go back into their home, they've got to try to transfer these skills. Now, I would hope, but I don't know for sure, that there's some sort of follow-up in the home. And this is where I felt like the home teaching was much to the advantage.
But you had to, I've talked to some home teachers before. Did you, you had to find your own driver, or did they furnish you with one?
Well, like I say, when I had a mobility instructor, I had a built-in driver. But when I didn't have a mobility instructor, I did have to find my own drivers. They were paid. And then sometimes I hopped a bus. And I had 17 counties to cover.
My heavens.
Yeah, and so, and this was back between 74 and 79. So I had all this, these counties to cover, and so I would hop a bus maybe and go about 100 miles away from Charleston up to Florence area, and then a driver, I would pick up a driver in Florence, and we would go to little places like Sally, South Carolina, and Mullins, and Dillon.
But you base for a week or so out of one town and try to make all the little...
Well, yeah, I would spend the night in, maybe spend a night or two in the Florence area, and yeah, and do just that.
Well, that just, I would hate that. I would, it would just, you know, because you'd be on the road, you'd be... You know, they'd have to pay me a lot to do that.
Well, and let me tell you.
And they don't. I know.
The reason why I ended up quitting was I said I really want to be a rehab counselor. I wanted to go into counseling. It was my psychology talk.
Yeah.
So I tried to start taking courses. Part of what got me started was I had to renew my teaching certificate. And so I kept going. Well, I was trying to go to school and work at the same time. I was going to school one summer, four nights a week, and working during the daytime.
Hmm.
And by August, my body was saying, halt, whoa, Dobbin, all of this. And I started ending up with some problems. So by October of that year, I decided, in 79, I decided... I was going to concentrate on getting my master's because it was making me car sick to do all this traveling. And
yeah.
I had been susceptible to car sick in earlier years. But I think because of my general rundown state
working
at that
and,
point,
working and going to school. Yeah,
yeah, burning
sure.
the candle at both ends.
Yeah.
I decided I would quit and just concentrate on going to school. And I got nearly a master's in educational counseling. I got nearly a master's in guidance counseling. And if there's any big regret in my life, it's that nearly the master's part. Because I was scared of the actual practical work of actually counseling people.
So you did not get the master's?
I did not get the master's because at that point I felt like that I felt extremely, extremely responsible for other people's lives. Counseling can be a highly effective thing or it can be a highly destructive thing.
But you couldn't leave it alone. You heard a story from somebody and you worried about that for days. You couldn't just counsel them and go on to the next one.
Right. Yeah, it was, yeah, okay, That was part of it. I'm very, very empathetic. I think that I would have taken people's problems on. But I also felt extremely responsible and felt that this was where my lack of confidence came in. And it had nothing to do with my vision. It was strictly the fact that I worried that I would do something to destroy somebody's life. That I would say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. And now I have learned that counselors are just as human as anybody else.
And you're not responsible for anyone else's emotions.
And I'm not responsible for how somebody's going to take something.
That's
but obviously
correct.
I would not try to do something deliberately destructive.
But this bothered you so bad that you couldn't function as a counselor.
I just felt that I could not go ahead and take that practical work. I felt like that I was also at a part in my life that I felt like that maybe I needed counseling, and I knew that part of what makes a good counselor is actually going through counseling yourself. So this is basically what I started to do.
All right, Barbara, we're down to about 90 seconds. Where are you now? What is your life like now?
Oh, gosh, we could go another hour.
Well, I know.
Life right now is that I am concentrating on doing my autobiography. I am concentrating on doing a fictional family thing with my family. And I'm hoping that I can really concentrate on that and not be so distracted by all the volunteer projects that I think I want to take on from time to time.
So you want to maybe concentrate on one thing, and then you're writing a biography, and what is this family thing you're doing?
A fictional family autobiography. I started that, too. But I'm also beginning to be the editor of the Tape Recording and Conversation Club's newsletter.
Want to tell us about that? Is that open to blind people?
Definitely.
Okay, well, we've got about 45 seconds. Tell us about this club.
It's where people get together and they tape correspond, email correspond, however way you want to correspond.
Okay. How does one get involved in this? What is it? Can you give us an email address or something?
Oh, gosh. TaperJohn1@juno.com. TaperJohn1@juno.com.
At juno.com. And this will give you information about the club, or you can join that way. And you do what for them? You edit their Braille newsletter, or is it a tape newsletter or Braille newsletter?
It is beginning to be on tape only just this year. We're trying that.
With a tape only?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that sounds interesting. I wasn't aware of that, but this is open to all blind people, right?
Mm-hmm. And all sighted people.
Just whomever wants to.
Whoever wants to
join.
All over the world.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. I agree. We could talk another hour, but we are completely out of time. Good luck, and that's about all I can say. I want to read your fictional biography when you get through with it. Will you keep me in mind and see that I get a copy?
I'll try to do all the publicity I can because I want to make a million on the book, you know.
Well, maybe we can help you with that. Barbara Mattson's been our guest, and hang on just a minute, all right?